Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a source that, while it's not just presenting an opinion...
No, it feels more like it's declaring theological war. It's pretty intense stuff.
Exactly. And the topic. It seems simple on the surface. How will the Third Temple actually get built?
But, that question. It cracks open this huge, really charged debate within Jewish tradition. It goes deep.
It's not just about blueprints or construction timelines, is it?
Not at all. This gets right to the heart of defining human responsibility versus, you know, divine action. Are people commanded to actively build it right now by hand?
As a legal requirement, you mean?
Yes, as a standing mitzvah. Mm-hmm. Or is the whole thing going to descend like ready-made from heaven?
A
miracle.
And our source today takes a very, very strong stance.
Oh, absolutely. It's right? Fiercely polemical. The position is hardline. Building it is entirely a human job. Mandatory.
Right. The source insists it's a positive commandment, a mitzvat asa, and it must be built by human hands, no waiting.
And it calls the other idea, the descent from heaven view. Well, it calls it a disaster, a dangerous delusion.
Wow. Okay. So, strong language. It argues this view leads to canceling a core religious duty.
Precisely. So, our mission today is to unpack the legal arguments, the historical points this source makes. Why is this position so extreme?
And why does this writer see the passive view, the waiting view, as such a betrayal of faith?
Yeah, we need to follow the source's logic. It goes through the Torah, Maimonides, Rashi, even Kabbalah.
To figure out what's really required, action or patience. Let's dive in.
Okay, so let's start where the source puts most of its weight, the legal groundwork. Where does this mandate for human action actually come from?
Well, it anchors the whole thing right in the Torah, specifically Exodus 25. You know, when God commands the building of the tabernacle, the portable sanctuary.
Ah, the Mishkan in the desert.
Exactly. The source quotes verses 8 and 9, and let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them. And then it follows up with, exactly as I show you, even so shall you do.
And the emphasis isn't just on the dwelling part, but on the doing part, the verbs. Precisely. They zero in on the imperatives. Makvasuli mikdash and you shall do vishentasu.
The argument being, if it was just going to appear magically,
why command them to make it? Why give detailed plans? The language implies human agency, physical labor.
It sounds pretty direct when you put it like that.
The source presents it as definitive proof. Physical action required by people. No conditions about waiting for the Messiah or anything supernatural. It's a standing order.
Okay, and to really give this legal force, they bring in the heavyweight champion of Jewish law, Maimonides.
The Rambam.
You got it. Rambam is cited as the ultimate proof. He lists building the temple, the Beit HaBetura, as the 20th positive commandment, mitzvat asa number 20.
And that's critical because...
Because the source stresses that the mitzvah is the act of building itself, not just having a temple exist, but the duty to actually construct it.
So the process, the labor, that's the commandment.
Yes. And it falls on the whole community, not just leaders or priests. So if it's a positive command, a mitzvat asa, what are the stakes here? Why is the descent from heaven idea seen as so dangerous from this legal perspective?
Well, look, if it's a standing commandment, like, say, putting on tefillin or keeping Shabbat, then neglecting it is a serious violation.
So waiting for a miracle becomes actively breaking the law.
According to this source, yes. You're neglecting a duty commanded right there in the Torah, codified by Maimonides.
And it's universal.
Yes. The source emphasizes men and women. Everyone has to contribute. Effort, money, labor, just like they did for the tabernacle back in the desert.
Okay, so a legal duty, universally applied. And they must have historical examples to back this up, right? That seems like the strongest counter to the miracle idea.
Absolutely. They point straight to the Second Temple period.
After the first one was destroyed by the Babylonians.
Right. Do they sit around waiting? No. The text is they weren't negligent. Ezra, Zerubbabel, Joshua. They led the people, they returned from exile, and they rebuilt it.
Following Solomon's original dimensions, more or less.
Yes. And even incorporating details from Ezekiel's prophecies, they did the mitzvah. They followed the precedent. Solomon built the first. They rebuilt the second.
So the precedent is human action even after destruction.
That's the argument. The obligation remains firmly in human hands. It doesn't just vanish because the building is gone.
It really reframes it, doesn't it? From something maybe in the distant future to a kind of present ongoing legal obligation.
And that shift from future hope to present liability, that brings us to the next part of the source, which gets even heavier. He talks about the consequence of waiting.
Right. This is where they bring in that really intense quote from the Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud Tractate Yoma.
That's the one. The source quotes the sages. Any generation in whose days it is not built, it is accounted to them as if they destroyed it.
Wow. Okay, let's unpack that. As if they destroyed it? What does that even mean?
It's a devastating line. The source interpreted it to mean the generation failed. They had a duty to rebuild, to prevent the continued destruction, and they didn't fulfill it.
So if you believe it's just going to float down from the sky, why would the Talmud use language like that? As if you destroyed it.
Exactly. That's the contradiction the source jumps on. If it's purely a divine miracle, why blame the generation?
So the interpretation here is waiting equals neglect.
Worse than neglect. The source argues that waiting, or promoting the belief that you should wait for a miracle, that's a gross violation of a mitzvah.
And those who push the descent from heaven idea are therefore
effectively responsible, the source claims, for the temple remaining in ruins during their time. They are causing the destruction for their generation by promoting passivity.
That's incredibly harsh. And the source doesn't just leave it as a general critique. It names names, doesn't it? It targets a huge figure.
Yeah, this is where it gets really pointed. To challenge the miraculous descent idea, they go after Rashi.
Rashi, the foundational commentator. That's bold. Why Rashi?
Because, according to this polemicist, Rashi is the main source, or at least a primary propagator, of this dangerous delusion.
Where does Rashi say this?
They cite his commentary on the Talmud, Sukkah 41a. Rashi interprets a verse from Exodus, "A sanctuary, O Lord, your hands have established," to mean the future temple.
Okay.
And Rashi writes that this future temple will be built and perfected. It will be revealed and come down entirely from heaven.
Coming down entirely from heaven, that's pretty explicit.
Very explicit. And the source sees this as, well, shocking. Attacking Rashi is almost unheard of, usually.
So how do they justify calling Rashi's view an absolute delusion? I mean, it's Rashi.
They use a kind of historical common sense argument. If Rashi is right, if the temple must descend fully formed,
then why did Solomon build the first one, piece by piece, with human labor?
Exactly. And why did Zerubbabel and Joshua go through all the trouble of rebuilding the second one after the exile? Why didn't they just wait?
The source sees it as a major inconsistency. Legally, historically, yeah. It doesn't add up for them.
Right. It makes the past actions seem pointless almost, if the real temple was always meant to be a miracle.
So it sounds like the source views Rashi's interpretation as almost like an easy way out, swapping hard work for passive hope.
That's exactly the critique. They call it a lowly view. Why? Because it leads directly, they claim, to the cancellation of a positive commandment.
Canceling the mitzvah to build.
Yes. The polemicist is basically saying the Jewish people won't get redemption, won't understand their duties, won't fulfill them until this idea of waiting for a miracle is totally rejected.
So it's seen as a corruption of faith, expecting ease instead of, well, effort and struggle.
Precisely. The source sees it as a fundamental misunderstanding that needs to be corrected urgently.
Okay, so we've moved from legal duty to the sin of inaction to challenging Rashi. Now the argument shifts again, right? Towards the Messianic era itself.
Yes, because if building the temple is a human mitzvah, that has huge implications for how we identify the Messiah.
And again, the source leans heavily on Maimonides, on the Rambam's legal codes.
Absolutely. The Rambam defines the criteria for recognizing the true Messiah, the Mashiach. And according to Maimonides, how do we know?
By his actions, right?
Exactly. By his actions. Specifically, two key actions. First, he successfully builds the temple. And second, he gathers the dispersed of Israel.
And crucially, what's not required?
Miracles. The source really emphasizes this point from the Rambam. The Messiah does not need to perform signs, wonders, split seas, or revive the dead to prove who he is.
So the proof is practical. Concrete success in construction and national unification. That's it.
That's the test, according to Maimonides, as presented here. And they use a historical example to make the point even sharper.
Bar Kokhba.
Yes. The Rambam discusses how the great sage Rabbi Akiva initially thought Bar Kokhba might be the Messiah. He was a powerful leader fighting the Romans.
But he failed and was killed.
Right. And because he failed, and the Rambam adds, because he sinned, it became clear he was not the Messiah. So the precedent is set. Success in these key actions is the proof. Failure or death before completion is disproof.
And the logic follows. If the Messiah has to build the temple to prove he's the Messiah,
then the temple can't already be built and waiting up in heaven to descend. His main verifying act would be redundant.
That makes sense within this framework. Okay, now we get to maybe the most explosive part of this source material.
Yeah, this is where it gets really aggressive.
The author doesn't just say the miraculous descent idea is wrong or inconsistent. They claim it's foreign, not authentically Jewish at all.
This is the core of the polemic's fiercest attack. The source claims that this whole doctrine, the temple descending from heaven, it actually originates outside of authentic Jewish tradition.
Specifically where?
They allege it comes directly from the unclean Christian New Testament.
Wow. Do they cite anything specific?
They do. They point to the book of Revelation, chapter 21, verse 2. It describes the New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband.
So the source is drawing a direct line from that Christian text to the interpretations of people like Rashi.
Yes, and arguing that promoting this descent idea has essentially contaminated Jewish thought, making it pro-Christian in its patterns, confusing the duty to act with a passive waiting for, well, for grace, essentially.
That is a really, really strong accusation. And the attack doesn't stop there, does it? It also targets certain mystical traditions within Judaism.
Right. They use this pejorative term.
Yeah.
The Zoharic New Testament.
Okay. Zoharic, referring to the Zohar, the foundational text of Kabbalah. So they're attacking Kabbalistic ideas, too.
Yes. And here, look, we have to be really careful just to report what the source claims impartially. The source attacks these mystical texts not just for promoting passivity, but for introducing what it considers, well, extreme and impure anthropomorphic ideas about God.
Anthropomorphic meaning describing God in human terms.
Exactly. The source finds certain Kabbalistic concepts offensive, linking them to what it calls filthy, revolting impurity.
Okay, can we quickly define the Kabbalistic terms being attacked here, just so we understand the context of the polemic?
Sure. So classical Kabbalah talks about the 10 sephiro divine emanations or aspects of God. The source specifically targets two. Yesod, which means foundation, often seen as a channel for divine life force, sometimes metaphorically linked to a male generative principle.
Yeah.
And Shekinah, or Malchert, meaning kingship, often depicted allegorically as the divine feminine presence, God's bride or wife, who is in exile with the Jewish people.
Understood. So how does the source use these specific Sephiro Yesod and Shekinah Malchut to make its case about impurity?
Well, the source alleges, and again, we're just reporting the allegation that these mystical texts contain really extreme claims that distract from action. Specifically, they claim these texts say, one, that righteous people, the tzaddikim, can somehow control God's organ of perception, the Yesod.
Control it.
That's the allegation. And second, that the Shekinah, the divine presence, is sort of waiting. Waiting to be warmed up by the righteous, described as sitting with them as a bride adorned before she can reunite with her husband, sometimes called katzar apayim or short-tempered, for cohabitation.
Wow. Okay. So by focusing on these divine dramas, these relationships between
The source argues that people get distracted. They shift their focus away from the concrete physical mitzvah to build the temple and instead focus on these internal mystical dynamics.
And the argument is that this focus, combined with the idea of the temple descending, leads to total passivity.
Exactly. That's the core of their aggressive stance. Mm-hmm. They believe these ideas descend from heaven, plus these mystical concepts have caused the Jewish people to just wait. Wait for God's internal reunion. Wait for the building to appear.
Instead of doing the required mitzvah themselves.
Right. And by doing so, they are delaying redemption. The source sees it as an urgent need to detoxify, intellectually and physically, from this passive mindset. It's a callback to action. Hashtag outro.
So we've really dug into this incredibly fierce polemic. A source that is, as you said, declaring theological war against passivity. What's the main takeaway here?
I think the biggest takeaway is how this source defines the ultimate purpose, the telos of the Jewish people. It's not about waiting for a miracle. It's about mandatory active construction.
Building the temple, gathering the exiles, those two key actions.
Yes. The whole nature of religious obedience is on the line. For this writer, any tension between human legal duty and, say, faith in divine intervention has to be resolved firmly on the side of human action. Now, collectively.
It really highlights how, you know, seemingly subtle differences in interpretation can explode into totally opposing worldviews.
Absolutely. Like interpreting one phrase in Exodus, your hands have established. Mm. Does it mean God established it in the past or will establish it miraculously in the future?
Or whether Maimonides' legal code leaves any room for a miraculous shortcut to fulfilling the mitzvah. These aren't small academic points for this author.
No, they lead to completely different paths. One demands immediate collective work. The other demands patient waiting. Even hostile paths, as we've seen.
And this connects back to the Rambam's criteria for the Messiah, which the source kept returning to.
Right. The source is so passionate because it believes the world is moving towards serving God together through the spread of Torah laws and messianic ideals, even if they're initially misunderstood.
Rambam even mentions that groups like Christians or Muslims might initially get the message wrong.
But the ultimate, undeniable success of the true messianic king, verified by his actions, that success will instantly show everyone the truth. It will correct all previous misunderstandings.
So here's the final thought, maybe. If the true Messiah is verified solely by human-led success building the temple, gathering the exiles, what kind of undeniable, practical success would it actually take?
Yeah, what level of achievement would be so powerful, so unifying, that it could overturn centuries of deeply held beliefs, like the idea of miraculous descent that this source fights against?
Convincing generations who are taught to wait patiently that their tradition was, as this source claims, a dangerous delusion. That's the ultimate test of action versus faith, isn't it? What would that success actually look like on the ground?